This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, March 30th. I'm Max Pringle, in for Matt Martin. Coming up, representatives of the Zapatista National Liberation Army address the Mexican Congress in an historic appeal for indigenous rights. Top Indian government and military officials caught on tape accepting bribes for ersatz arms deals, and
war crimes trials to be conducted here in Serbia. I would like Serbs to know that they have committed war crimes, but The Hague is no help there.
As Macedonian forces go on the offensive against Albanian guerrillas, Yugoslav officials tighten the noose on former President Slobodan Milosevic, who could be arrested any day and sent to The Hague. These stories and more coming up on Free Speech Radio News. Two days after an historic appearance before a joint session of Mexico's Congress to lobby for an indigenous rights bill, representatives of the Zapatista rebel army are heading back to Chiapas. Now the ball is in the government's court. President Vicente Fox plans to send his chief of staff to speak on behalf of the legislation from the same podium, and the Mexican Congress begins the debate on passage of the bill. Travis Lee reports from Mexico City.
Zapatista journey from the mountainous jungles of Chiapas to the capital reached its culmination when a delegation of rebel commanders spoke for 3 hours to the full Congress in Mexico City. Many seats were empty, however, since members of President Fox's National Action Party chose not to attend, sapping some credibility from Fox's calls for indigenous rights. The appearance of the masked leaders inside the elegant halls of Congress suggests peace negotiations have begun in earnest, and the absence of the highly visible military leader Marcos ratified that the path ahead is a political one. Comandante Esther was the main speaker for the Zapatistas.
Ordenamos al compañero subcomandante insurgente Marcos.
We ordered Subcomandante Marcos that he take the necessary measures so that we make no military advance on the bases which have been vacated by the Federal Army. We ordered him to maintain our forces in their current positions in the mountains.
El Ejército Federal y que ordene que nuestras fuerzas se mantengan en sus posiciones actuales de montaña.
Mexico's Congress must get down to the rough and tumble of debating legislation which was formulated by a broad-based group of lawmakers and popular organizations. The Zapatistas have been clear. They want the initiative passed without changes, as Comandante David told the Congress.
La aprobación y elevar a rango constitucional esta iniciativa significa garantizar la vida, el respeto,
the approval and the support on the constitutional level of this initiative means guaranteeing the life, respect, and fundamental rights of indigenous people. It means the creation of a new society based on justice, equality, and in the respect for the indigenous with all its diversity of languages and cultures. A society where we'll no longer be humiliated, marginalized, and excluded, and where we don't have to rise up in arms just to be heard.
Donde ya no tengamos que levantarnos en armas para ser escuchados.
The Indigenous Rights and Culture Initiative would guarantee education and access to media in the some 60 native Mexican languages. It would also provide for basic development of schools, clinics, and roads. Perhaps the most controversial aspect would grant indigenous Mexicans power to exercise their own traditional legal systems, potentially pitting them against federal laws that prohibit things like arranged marriages for youth and burning forests for agricultural use. Conservative Congressman Fernando Perez hopes the EZLN and their political allies will respect the spirit of parliamentary debate.
Based on the speeches and the tone of their words, it seems like they want to impose a certain project. And we all know that in a parliamentary process, you can modify initiatives. It would be very dangerous to see inflexibility by the EZLN when Congress has shown just the opposite.
The Zapatistas leave Mexico City this weekend, where their political delegate, once a political prisoner under President Ernesto Zedillo, will pick up the negotiations. In Mexico City, I'm Travis Lee for Free Speech Radio News.
This week, heavy fighting between Macedonian forces and ethnic Albanian guerrillas has focused the world's attention once again on the Balkans, as a British journalist and an ethnic Albanian youth were killed in shelling attacks in the Yugoslav province of Kosovo. Meanwhile, the Bush administration is preparing to certify that Yugoslavia is cooperating with the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague, Netherlands. Congress had set a deadline of Saturday for Belgrade to meet several requirements or face losing some $50 million in aid. Meanwhile, the most sought-after suspect, former President Slobodan Milosevic, remains free. And as Free Speech Radio News correspondent Jeremy Scahill reports from Belgrade, this is just the beginning of the battle over the fate of the former Yugoslav leader.
During last year's election in Yugoslavia, Vojislav Koštunica promised that should he win, he would not hand his predecessor Slobodan Milosevic over to the Hague Tribunal. Koštunica has repeatedly blasted the Hague as anti-Serb and a private court for American justice. The stance has won him widespread popularity in a country that for a decade had been painted a pariah by the international community. But many of the politicians that rose to power on Koštunica's coattails are now backtracking on the pledge. A growing number of officials are campaigning to have Milosevic extradited. So severe is the rift within the ruling Democratic Opposition of Serbia, or DOS coalition, that it threatens to break apart the government.
The issue of Milosevic extradition could bring down the federal government in Yugoslavia.
Liliana Smilovic is an expert on U.S.-Yugoslav relations for the Belgrade magazine NIN.
That same issue could bring down also the Serbia government, where you only have DOS, because some parties, and notably Vojislav Koštunica, I think, is opposed. I think Koštunica personally and his party are opposed to the extradition. How strongly they feel about that, we are yet to see. But if they decide to fight it, the people who are against extradition can easily bring down both governments, the federal one in Yugoslavia and Serbia's government in Belgrade.
In addition to his political opposition to the tribunal, Koštunica, a constitutional law expert, says Yugoslav law forbids the extradition of its citizens. He was outraged last week when officials from his government handed over former Bosnian Serb leader Milomir Stakic, who was wanted under a sealed indictment issued in March of 1997. Koštunica called the extradition a precedent that should not have been set. Television shows like this one have been popping up on Serbia's airwaves. It's a debate on whether or not Yugoslavia should cooperate fully with The Hague. The Serbian Justice Minister Vladan Badic, who authorized the handover of Milomir Stakic to The Hague last week, said on the program that the government is currently drafting a new law to permit the extradition of Yugoslav citizens. The 31st of March was not a deadline or a D-Day, Badic says. We have done a lot of things in a short amount of time. Extradition wasn't one of the U.S. demands. We cannot impose the moment of arrest of Milosevic. That would be ignoring institutions of a free and independent judicial system, he says. On the streets of Belgrade, people gather near a kiosk, listening to the music of a new CD called Serbia Sounds Global. Here on the streets, the issue of Milosevic's fate is taking a backseat to what many consider to be more pressing issues, not the least of which are the ongoing attacks by Albanian militants on Yugoslav forces and Serb villages in the southern Preševo Valley. 26-year-old Novak Gajic is a graduate student of political science.
Well, Serbia now has is country with serious problems. Problems in economy, problems in security, countries under attack of Albanian terrorists coming from Kosovo, actually from U.S.-controlled sector. And at this moment, when Milosevic can do no harm, when he's practically immobilized and political support to him means practically nothing at the moment, I think that extradition of Milosevic to the Hague Tribunal shouldn't be the priority of U.S. politics.
There is little debate in Belgrade about whether or not Milosevic should stand trial. Most want him prosecuted. But many who are opposed to the Hague Tribunal say they want him tried in Belgrade by Serbian judges. But should that happen, the former president would most likely face charges of corruption and assassination of political opponents, and not the more serious charges of genocide and crimes against humanity. Again, Liliana Smilovic from the Belgrade magazine, NIN.
I would like war crimes trials to be conducted here in Serbia. I would like Serbs to know that they have committed war crimes, but The Hague is no help there. I do not believe that, as some of my former colleagues in other republics notably Bosnia and Zagreb, are saying that the history of the Balkans will be written in The Hague. I think The Hague is simply an institution that has outlived its purpose, and while I find it natural that any institution wants to expand, wants always a bigger budget, when the sense, the purpose of its existence has ceased, they try to invent a new one, they want to have more employees, I can understand that, but The Hague simply should go away. And these countries, if they're democratic, if they're decent countries, they should have trials here where their own people trust in their judges.
Some senior officials in the government say Slobodan Milosevic could be arrested within days. Aides to President Vojislav Koshtunica say such a move is some time away. But one thing is certain. 6 months after he was deposed from power, Milosevic continues to haunt Serbian politics. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jeremy Scahill in Belgrade.
In India, a nationally televised program showing several top government bureaucrats and military officials accepting bribes from journalists posing as arms dealers threatens to bring down the country's ruling coalition. And, as Free Speech Radio News India correspondent Sputnik Colombi reports, the powerful BJP party is in damage control mode.
The uneasy coalition that the Hindu right-wing BJP party sits astride has never appeared as shaky. The picture of its president shown reaching out for wads of rupees while expressing his preference for dollars in order to facilitate a defense deal will not be erased from the public consciousness anytime soon. The party president, as well as Defense Minister George Fernandes, in whose house some of the wheeling-dealing took place, were finally forced to resign, but only when the coalition threatened to come apart. Already one ally has quit the ship. Threatening noises continue from other parties making up the coalition. In all, some 34 individuals were caught in the hidden cameras of the aptly named news portal Tehelka, which means wave in Hindi. The revelations in themselves come as no surprise. Much greater sums of money have been known to change hands, and no political party in the country, with the exception perhaps of some left parties, has remained untainted by corruption charges at some time or the other. Corruption is part of the body politic in India, which figures unflatteringly high on the world list of most corrupt nations. The difference is that the Tehelka expose showed the nation every brazen detail of the whys and wherefores of such deals. Plausible deniability was impossible, even if the defense deal itself was fictitious. Those caught in the Tehelka trap ranged from the lowest ranks of the civil service to the highest rungs of political authority, all the way up to the Prime Minister's office. A veritable nexus between the bureaucracy, the army, and the political establishment. The country's chief anti-corruption official publicly stated a few days ago that Indian democracy is based on corruption. Noted political critic and peace campaigner Admiral Ramdas says that the Tehelka tapes show how crucial the question of election financing is.
The root cause of many of these problems lie at the door of our electoral process. Our methods of raising funds for political parties, the lack of transparency and accountability for the funds that they receive within political parties. There is no legal requirement for them to put up an audited balance sheet of their party funds. If there was an electoral reform, there was a very clear statement of political parties accounting for their funds. Much of this would be, eradicated.
The government has tried to dismiss the Tehelka tapes as foreign or opposition-instigated conspiracy. Its plans to address mass rallies in major cities to drum up support in the coming days have been dismissed as a futile exercise. Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee came to power with national security and clean government stopping his agenda. Both claims now lie shattered, and the disarray within the coalition is growing by the day. The main opposition Congress party is milking this for what it's worth, but its own past record and likely future performance lend it little credibility. While political pundits warn against another round of elections, the scandal refuses to go away and demands for Prime Minister Vajpayee and the entire government to take moral responsibility and resign continue. One might argue that other equally important issues are being sidelined. The recent anti-people budget, the daily suicides of farmers, the controversial sellout of a profit-making public service company, to name only a few. But clearly, India is at a turning point in its long overdue confrontation with corruption.
It's a wake-up call for all the political parties to start with. And also it's a wake-up call for the general administrative machinery. I think for far too long they've been able to fool most people most of the time. But I think for now, once and for all, they've been found out. And let's hope that this will have a salutary effect on their both their performance as well as in the levels of integrity that they demonstrate in their future.
Judging from the tone of public debate and opinion, the people of India have heard that wake-up call. This is Sputnik Kilambi for Free Speech Radio News.
Four states have passed laws that allow state officials to step in and take control of low-performing schools or districts. It's a national trend that's likely to grow. President Bush's education program recommends sanctions, including takeovers for schools whose scores on standardized tests don't improve. In 1993, the California State Department of Education seized control of the Compton School District in South Los Angeles County, citing both corruption of local officials and low academic performance. They said leaky roofs, filthy classrooms, and teachers who didn't come to class made learning impossible. Now, the state has returned some authority to local officials. A report released this month recommends the local board take more control. Robin Yurovich reports on how the Compton schools are faring.
California School Superintendent Delaine Easton says under the state supervision, the Compton schools have come a long way.
And those kids were in the bottom one percentile of performance of the entire state. Their schools were falling down around their ears. They didn't have textbooks. They didn't have credentialed teachers. They were just people trying to line their pockets.
But the takeover has not been smooth. 4 years after the state took control of the school district, conditions for its 30,000 mostly African American and Latino students remained so poor that in 1997, the American Civil Liberties Union filed suit, charging students were denied their right to an equal education. As a result of that lawsuit, State Superintendent Delaine Easton's department now operates the district under court supervision.
We instituted a lot of procedures for cleaning the schools, painting the schools, making sure that those parts of the schools that were either unsafe or unfit for human occupation were cleaned out.
While the state report recommends returning more control to the local school district, it warns the board to change its behavior or risk losing its new authority. Some members are accused of threatening to fire staff and breaking confidentiality laws. The state's criticism fuels long-standing resentment of the takeover. School board member Saul Langster.
They're ripping this school district off, going in common, and they don't want to leave. We want to get them the hell out of here, but they won't leave. They're the relative that moves in that and living high off on the hog, and they will not leave. They're going to have to be evicted.
Some city officials are so upset with state control that they've placed a special question on this April's municipal ballot, asking voters if they want to secede from the school district. The measure is only symbolic. But the state does appear to be handing back control. The Department of Education returned the operation of facilities and community relations to the board based on reports by its fiscal crisis and management team. Now the state is recommending that the board take over management of curriculum, testing, and staff training. On a recent morning, a team of state officials and attorneys from the ACLU conducted their regular monthly inspection at Compton's Dominguez High School.
Okay, first of all, there are 15 items on this campus facilities review, and they range from restrooms all the way to textbooks. They cover things
like... The state's independent consultant, Mark Dees, gave Dominguez High School high marks this week on its physical plant and the availability of textbooks. But students and teachers at the school say it's proven easier to fix concrete problems like leaky roofs than to improve academic performance.
We rinse the school off. The school looks shiny, but it's still cruddy on the inside.
Jennifer Hall is a senior headed for Cal State Northridge next year.
We have Scrabble in our class now. We have checkers. We have things that keep you busy during the 2 hours instead of learning.
The district hasn't placed priority on education. It's placed priority on looking good on paper.
Social studies teacher Eric Sharp says instructors are expected to follow orders instead of participating in decision-making. He says standardized tests and paperwork that can be sent to the state to document progress is more important than anything that goes on in the classroom.
There are times where you ask yourself if I'm not being treated as a professional, if I'm being required to, in a sense, act like a robot, then what is the point? And it does affect your teaching, absolutely. You do see a lot of busy work in other classes. You see busy work in my class, which disgusts me.
Test scores have inched upward in about half of Compton schools, but college admissions for high school seniors still lag behind. Classrooms remain overcrowded, and there continues to be a severe teacher shortage. Still, State Administrator Randolph Ward argues there is progress happening in the district.
I mean, specifically, there have been real gains in the area of student achievement in math and language and reading, and they've been incrementally real gains.
Across the country, takeovers have been mostly effective in restoring the fiscal health of bankrupt school districts. But many educators say state control has done little so far to boost academic achievement. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Robin Urovich in Compton.
In an outbreak of controversy in the long-running conflict between the Pacifica Foundation and its critics, the executive director of Pacifica, the oldest and largest progressive radio network in America, and its board chair, interrupted the programming of Pacifica's radio stations multiple times last Monday to warn against what they called violent attacks against Pacifica and its staff. Free Speech Radio News correspondent David Landau reports.
The spark that lit this prairie fire took place in Houston last Friday afternoon when a group of four people handed out leaflets in front of Pacifica radio station KPFT, and an altercation occurred. Station manager Garland Ganter and development director Molly O'Brien filed assault charges against Edwin Johnston, who has been a volunteer at KPFT for 20 years. Johnston spent 8 hours in jail Friday afternoon and evening. Now he faces two counts of C-class misdemeanor assault. Pacifica Executive Director Bessie Wash interrupted both of Pacifica's national programs to make a 5-minute-long statement on the incident. In a separate broadcast, Pacifica Board Chair David Acosta, who is from the Houston area, leveled a severe warning against the anti-Pacifica protesters.
Those of you who forget what Pacifica stands for and engage in violent or criminal activities against staff, national board members, volunteers, family members, or the assets of the organization will have removed themselves from the Pacifica community and will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
Pacifica also issued a written statement on the incident in Houston, claiming that the foundation's opponents have shown a pattern of violence in their protests. In particular, the written statement denounced the Pacifica campaign, which former Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez has formed to oppose fundraising at the Pacifica stations. From Houston, Edwin Johnston offered his version of the events that led to his arrest. He said the altercation began when KPFT Development Director O'Brien tore leaflets from the hands of a demonstrator in front of the station, and Johnston himself took off after O'Brien, trying to get the leaflets back.
I tried to reach for the flyers, and she turned around again, and then she yelled, "Rape!" And then the next thing you know, I was blindsided by Garland Ganter, who shoved me violently, and then I started yelling at Garland for assaulting me. And then Garland came at me again, this time got me into some kind of bear hug. And while he was wrestling with me, some KPFT volunteer, boom, hits me on the other side of the body. And now I got two guys on me, and then I think even a third one came on me. And finally I was able to push at least one of them off, and then everybody got loose. After a while, the police showed up, and within a few minutes, after talking to Garland for most of the time and Molly, the police put handcuffs on me and threw me in the back of the car and took me to jail for two counts of assault.
O'Brien did not return calls requesting her comment on the incident. Station manager Garland Ganter, who is O'Brien's husband, explicitly declined to comment. Activists across the Pacifica network expressed outrage at the accusations of violence and also at the repeated interruptions of programming, which appeared to constitute a violation of Pacifica's own dirty laundry rule. Edwin Johnston faces arraignment on his assault charges April 18th.
Well, it seems to me that the Pacifica protests are so successful and have so frustrated the management and the board that they're having to resort to actual physical violence against the demonstrators, and to cover up for their violence, they have to falsely accuse us of violence against them, which is giving a false report to the police department, which is essentially a felony.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is David Landau.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of 321. Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. More than 40 reporters in 14 states and on four continents are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line and need your support. For more information, see our website, www.savepacifica.net/strike. That's www.savepacifica.net/strike. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz. Jade Paget-Seekins is our technical producer. Thanks to Vanessa Tate for technical assistance. I'm Max Pringle, in for Matt Martin. Thanks for listening.